Men John, de här fakturorna, har du koll på dem eller?
Att ha alla fakturor i en enda röra, det är inte Telia.
Oj, vad många.
Att göra det lätt att driva företag, det är Telia. Läs mer om fördelar med att samla IT, bredband och mobilt hos en leverantör på telia.se/företag.
Upptäck det vackra ljudet av McCrispy & Company för endast 89 kronor. En riktigt krispig upplevelse. För ett ännu godare McDonald's.
Hej, Susanne Axel här. När du gör som jag och listar dig på en av Krys vårdcentraler får du en fast läkarkontakt som kan din sjukdomshistoria. Du får träffa erfarna specialister, tillgång till lättakuten och så kan du chatta med vårdpersonalen. Så gör ditt viktigaste val idag. Lista dig hos Kry.
Young men who are coming from societies that are Muslim and sexually repressed to societies that are secular and where women have been emancipated for decades. It's a huge cultural clash. If the sexual violence against women is spiking because suddenly there is a surge of men from Iraq, Afghanistan, North Africa, Somalia, and so on, it's important to say to these communities, this particular spike is new.
I would say there are values that have to be non-negotiable, not give and take, just take. If you don't want to, you go back to your home country.
Hon är en kompromisslös försvarare av den västerländska civilisationen och den liberala demokratin. Kanske för att hon själv har offrat så mycket och behövt kämpa så hårt för att göra den till sin. För den somaliskfödda författaren och aktivisten Ayaan Hirsi Ali förändrades tillvaron drastiskt när hennes kollega och vän Theo van Gogh mördades av en muslimsk fundamentalist. Mordet var en våldsam reaktion på Submission, den film de två hade gjort tillsammans. På Theo van Goghs döda kropp fanns ett meddelande fastsatt med en kniv om att Ayaan Hirsi Ali stod näst på tur. Idag lever hon i USA där hon är forskarassistent på tankesmedjan Hoover Institution och där hon också grundat kvinnorättsstiftelsen AHA Foundation. Ett av de största hoten mot de liberala landvinningarna i västvärlden är de kvinnofientliga värderingar som invandrare från framförallt muslimska länder har med sig när de kommer till väst. Detta milt sagt kontroversiella budskap är kärnan i hennes nya bok Villebråd. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, most welcome to fredagsintervjun.
Jörgen, thank you very much for having me on.
I'd like to start by asking you about the ambiguity in the title of your book, Pray, because after the murder of Theo van Gogh, you yourself became a bit of a prey for violent Islamic fundamentalists. How were those first years after the murder for you?
They were stressful and, you know, there was the shock of the murder. And this is back in 2004, November of 2004. So the months after I had to leave the country and go into hiding and then get back into parliament, I think I was in hiding for about 2 months, something along those lines. But then even when I was back, it continued. I had to be moved from safe house to safe house. And, you know, the sense of being prey was very strong. But that experience is very different from the experience that of the women that I recount in this book.
Mm. In what way?
In my case, the radical Islamists who said they were offended by my work, they wanted to come after me because of my ideas and the fact that I was taking advantage of the freedom in the Netherlands and other free countries to express those ideas and share it with other people. But the subject of prey is different. The men who are attacking the women in the streets are not necessarily driven by ideology. They are driven by this universal impulse that apparently men all over the world have, but this is unconstrained. And they look at European women in the streets and they think that these women are not good according to the definition of their worldview. Where they come from, they divide women into good women and bad women, and bad women are those who they see as prey, and they hunt them down. And sometimes it's one individual doing it, but very often it is in groups of two, three, four. They don't know the women that they're attacking most of the time. And even in the cases where there is familiarity between the victim and the perpetrator, it is very superficial. It's an acquaintance. It's somebody they have had a conversation with at a restaurant or at a nightclub. So it's not really people who have had a relationship the way that is seen, you know, from a technical perspective. When we talk about, there are different types of sexual assault. There is that's committed by those who are well acquainted with the victim, like boyfriends and husbands. And then there is stranger rape and stranger assault and harassment. And in this case, in the stories that I tell in Prey, it's almost all in the category of stranger encounters.
Mm. In the new book, you describe how the freedom and liberties of women are under attack in Europe, specifically because of this problem that you talk about now. Which are the most obvious signs of that these freedoms are, in fact, threatened?
I think for me, the most obvious sign is the freedom of movement, the freedom and the protection on the right to bodily integrity, the sexual freedom of women. So this is purely from the standpoint of, you know, you have young men preying on women, and the immediate effect of that is that women feel afraid to come out and go about their business without having to think about their safety first. But I think if you think about it more deeply, you can also see it as a violation of the rule of law. And because as you've seen in your country, the victim is the first person who's affected. But in general, you see, if the crimes are not stopped, what a secondary effect, but in some ways, I think more serious, is that the population think that the government institutions whose job it is to protect them, these institutions cannot be trusted. And so it starts to imply that, and this is where I think most people get this wrong. They think, oh, well, it's something, these women should not be where they get into trouble to begin with, or it's not my problem, it's their problem. But if you think through and you think deeply about these issues, it is really, it's an erosion of the rule of law. It's an erosion of the freedoms of speech. In every country that I have spoken to victims, many of them feel that no one really cares. And when they try to express what happened, people are more concerned about scolding them about bigotry and racism than they are about really listening to the victims and understanding how their freedom of movement is threatened and how their bodily integrity is threatened.
We'll get deeper into that in a few minutes, but I don't know if you're aware, but your book lands like sort of a torch in a debate that's been going on in Sweden for a while. In the last big TV debate between the leading politicians in Sweden a month ago from now, that was the topic of the most fiery argument. I'm going to play you a clip in Swedish that I'll translate for you afterwards.
Att vi ser en sån kraftigt mörkertal kring sexualbrottslighet mot unga kvinnor, hävdar jag, hänger i väldigt hög grad ihop med import av medeltida värderingar kring relation mellan könen. Det vill säga, vi har importerat värderingar som vi har mer eller mindre utrotat från det här landet tidigare. Men genom en ansvarslös invandringspolitik så kommer det här tillbaka. Och det är därför vi också ser att det här ökar.
Vi kan väl höra med Annie Lööf.
Så jag känner sånt förakt när jag hör ditt resonemang, Jimmy Åkesson.
Jag brukar göra det, så jag är inte förvånad.
I decennier så har kvinnor blivit misshandlade, torterade och mördade i sina egna hem. Den vanligaste orsaken till att kvinnor dör av våld är i hemmet, det är oftast i sängen och det är det är en gärningsperson som hon antingen har levt med eller lever med. Och du, i ditt första inlägg så måste du påtala att det här är ett importerat problem.
You've just gotten a brief translation from me. What's your reflection on this argument between these two leading Swedish politicians?
Again, I'm just going off on the very limited context that you've given me. But I want to say, yes, women have been victims of male violence for centuries. That is absolutely true. But in Sweden, in 2020, 2021, in the 21st century, a lot of that violence is committed by immigrant men who indeed are importing what are medieval values to Sweden from countries that have not evolved the way Sweden has and the way other European countries have. And it is absolutely necessary and urgent to acknowledge that reality if you are sincerely interested in protecting the rights of women and children.
But she gets so very angry with him. She says even that she feels contempt for him saying this. What do you think is the reason behind that?
I'm telling you, I have the limited context that you're giving me.
Yeah, but basically what he said is what you're writing in your book.
Yes, and I've seen and I've heard this in other European countries. There is an ideological fixation that immigrants, because they are minorities and because they are vulnerable, should not be held to the same standards as everyone else, as the standards that the majority men are held to in this particular case. So she is displaying that same ideological expression where, in her view, the fact that this man of the Swedish Democrats is articulating the problems that are faced by Swedish women in the hands of immigrant men to her is more contemptible. The fact that he's talking about to her is more contemptible than what is actually happening to the women. And this is a predicament for 21st century feminism. They are more interested in the ways in which minorities may be viewed or may be stigmatized rather than some of the real harm that they're causing.
Couldn't that stigma also cause harm on many innocent, for instance, Muslim men? So it is like a balance there between him and her.
I have found out in the course of the last 20 years that the more we avoid holding immigrant individuals responsible and accountable for their behavior, the more all immigrants are stigmatized. In other words, her attitude, this woman's attitude and what she is saying makes innocent immigrants more vulnerable towards stigmatization than if she were to acknowledge that there is a real problem today that women, and it's not just white Swedish women who are attacked by immigrant men, it's also immigrant women. So right now, the sexual violence that's unfolding in the streets of places like Sweden and Germany and Austria and France, most of that is perpetrated by immigrant men or the children of immigrant men. And it's very important to acknowledge that. And the more we try to put a taboo around that, the more we hurt the innocent immigrants who do not engage in these activities and actually who condemn those activities.
Many people claim it's also a matter of class, that underprivileged people always commit more violent crimes regardless of cultural or ethnic background. Do you think they have a point?
I don't know if it is, and I don't think I want to speculate on whether underprivileged people commit more crimes. But what I can see when it comes to class is that the working class neighborhoods and working class women in particular, they are the ones who are bearing the burden of the negative impact of immigration. And the parties on the left, Social Democrats and anything on the left of that, they have abandoned these constituencies. So if you want to talk about class, then let's talk about the question of why almost all immigrants are settled in working class neighborhoods. And then when the residents of those neighborhoods complain about that negative impact, why they're dismissed as racists and xenophobes. Right now, that is the class conflict that I see.
In your book, you mention a large number of incidents that has occurred in different European countries, many of them actually in Sweden. But one of the most well-known mass assault happened in the German city Köln. How did that mass assault change the debate around this issue in Europe, you think?
I think it changed in a number of ways. One, because it was so massive and it affected hundreds of women simultaneously, it was very difficult for the mainstream media to not report it. So the event, the incident was reported. And I think what the second way in which the Cologne incident exposed this particular problem, again, perpetrated by some immigrant men, not all of them, is the inability or the inadequate ways in which the institutions deal with it. Law enforcement, the justice system, the data collecting agency. So when I was writing this book, I would just simply go and ask for the data on sexual violence. And I would be told, oh, sorry, we don't collect data on, you know, such things as nationality, ethnicity, religion, etc. So if you want to answer the question, how immigration has affected sexual violence in Sweden or Germany or Holland, you actually can't answer it because we are told we don't collect data on that. And I think what happened in Cologne, it exploded that vision because now it was no longer possible to hide.
But can you sympathize with the thoughts behind this, that the authorities don't want to divide people into immigrants and Swedes? They want to consider people as individuals.
But that's exactly what they're not doing. If you consider people as individuals, then when an individual commits a crime or is suspected of a crime, you note down all of the relevant facts. And it is, in this case, sexual violence, suddenly when there is this spike and it's clearly related to young men who are coming from foreign countries, it's a very important data point to note who exactly it is, like you would note their age. That's important. Noting their nationality and ethnicity is important in trying then to figure out why it's happening and what kinds of policies we can put in place to stop that from happening. You need this information. But if you say, oh, you know, as authorities, we simply want to protect minorities from stigma, I think you're going to achieve the opposite. And that's exactly what happened in the last 20 years. What I have seen is an increase in populist parties and the vote for far-right parties. And this is all driven by the attitude of the authorities that they should keep these things silent.
But we have to acknowledge, I think, that this is a tricky political issue, because how do you describe the problem without collectively blame a whole group of people just on the basis of their ethnicity? If you say immigrant men from these and these countries are more likely to commit these crimes, even innocent men from those countries will feel blamed in some way, don't you think?
I think what I've been seeing in the last decades is that there is a defensiveness on the part of immigrant communities, particularly Muslim communities. And they feel that when an act of terrorism or an act of crime is committed by an individual, if the details of that crime, if that is publicized, they feel that the whole community is blamed. Now, that's a fact. That's how they feel. But the response from the authorities and the rest of society is to explain to them, no, this is not a blame of the entire community. This is simply to show that these are some of the things that are taking place within your community. We should address this together. So if the sexual violence against women is spiking because suddenly there is a surge of men from Iraq, Afghanistan, North Africa, Somalia, and so on, it's important to say to these communities, this particular spike is new, and this particular spike has to do something with your community, and we should do this together. But I think pretending that it's not happening is only going for the wider society. It has the opposite effects. People think it's immigrant men who are committing these. They may think it's all or few. But what they also think is that they don't have any trust in the institutions whose job it is to deal with these issues. So if you're a tax-paying woman and you're attacked in the streets, you have to ask yourself, what should I do now? I've reported it to the police. They're ignoring it. Politicians are ignoring it. I can't go to my council members. I've been dismissed as a racist over and over again. But these attacks continue to take place. Now what? And that is, I think, where the far-right parties and the populist parties come onto the platforms. They come into the stage and say, if you elect us, we are going to solve the problem. And is that what we want?
Let's talk a little bit about why this is. You claim that these ideas about women, how they are supposed to act and dress to avoid being assaulted, is profoundly learned by young men, especially in countries in the Muslim world. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yes, I write in detail in the book that when you're growing up in a Muslim majority society, the relationship between men and women it's codified. And some of that is written, especially where Sharia law is the law of the land. It's written law, it's formal law, it's formalized. But very often it's informal and it's not written, but it's still codified. And so these young men grow up looking at women and dividing them into those who are good and protected by their menfolk and those who are not good. And the ones who are not good are called immodest. They're not virtuous. They're not protected by their male relatives and therefore they're prey. Now, I'm not blaming the men for being raised with these cultural and religious attitudes. That's just how they grow up. But once they come into Europe, I think it's very important to have a conversation with them on an individual basis and explain to them that it is very different in the countries that they have chosen to come to. And that if they behave, if they engage in this type of behavior against women, there'll be consequences. And then to hold them accountable and to hold them to those consequences. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
But what you write in your book is that the consequences in Europe are often so mild that the message is not carried through to these men. They don't understand that what they've done is really wrong. They think it's maybe a little wrong because the punishment is such a mild one compared to what they would get in their home country.
Absolutely. And sometimes they don't even think that they should be punished. They are confused. They think it's racism. They think if you don't want me to attack these women, then why are these women on the streets dressed as they are? Why are these women out and about at night? Why are they in a nightclub? Why are they in a restaurant? Because for them, places like nightclubs and restaurants, etc., are for men only. Women should not be there. And if women are there, then why would you be surprised that that they get attacked? And so I think there is a great deal of confusion, cultural confusion, value confusion between the young men who are coming from societies that are Muslim and sexually repressed to societies that are secular and where women have been emancipated for decades. It's a huge cultural clash, and it's very, very important to get things into the open so that the confusion can be lifted, and it's not fair to the young men to welcome them, and then, you know, when they just carry on behaving as they did, to give them the feeling that they've done wrong when they don't really know what it is that they've done wrong. When I spoke to some of the immigrant men, the children of immigrant men who grew up in Sweden and in Denmark, in Holland, in Austria, in Germany, they repeated the exact same sentiment, which is not to stigmatize these groups, not to kick them out of the country, none of that. They're just saying, we need to educate these young men. We need to tell them that all women as individuals are valued, that if you attack a woman, say in Sweden, that is not, women are not divided into good and bad. They're all good and they're all individuals, and you have no right to do that. That kind of integration into the value system is not taking place.
Du som lyssnar på det här kan göra det på grund av generösa donationer från andra nöjda lyssnare och läsare av Kvartal. Hela vår verksamhet bedrivs med hjälp av frivilliga bidrag. Och vill du också vara med i denna växande folkrörelse av frivillighet och därmed bidra till att Kvartal kan finnas kvar och växa? Gå in.
Men John, de här fakturorna, har du koll på dem eller?
Att ha alla fakturor i en enda röra, det är inte Telia.
Oj, vad många.
Att göra det lätt att driva företag, det är Telia. Läs mer om fördelar med att samla IT, bredband och mobilt hos en leverantör på telia.se/företag.
På Sveriges största jackpot-casino går Hypermiljonen på högvarv. Från Malmö i söder till Kiruna i norr har Hypermiljonen genererat över 130 miljoner exklusivt till våra spelare. Välkommen in till Sveriges största jackpot-casino, hyper.com.
18 plus, regler och villkor gäller.
Upptäck det vackra ljudet av McCrispy & Company för endast 89 kronor. En riktigt krispig upplevelse. För ett ännu godare McDonald's.
På kvartal/gava så berättar vi mer. Nu fortsätter fredagsintervjun med Ayan Hirsi Ali.
We'll get back to the possible measures, what can be done about this, but I want to ask you, in many countries in the Muslim world, there is a phenomenon called taharush. What is that?
That is the rape game. That is precisely the phenomenon that was in display in Cologne on New Year's Eve 2015, New Year's Day 2016. It is the experience that Lara Logan had when she was covering the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square in Egypt.
Now that you mention Lara Logan, it's a suitable time to play the clip I already prepared with her. She's an experienced foreign reporter who reported from the revolution on the Tahrir Square in 2011. When suddenly the camera battery goes down and the lights from the camera is extinguished. The next thing she knows, she's attacked by a mob. She later told this story in CBS 60 Minutes, and I have to warn sensitive listeners, this is quite a disturbing 2 minutes to hear.
Suddenly, before I even know what's happening, I feel hands grabbing my breasts, grabbing my crutch, grabbing me from behind. I mean, it's not, you know, one person and then it stops. It's like one person and another person, another person. And I know Ray is right there and he's grabbing at me and screaming, Lara, hold on to me, hold on to me. And I'm screaming, thinking if I scream, if they know, they're going to stop. You know, someone's going to stop them or they're going to stop themselves because this is wrong. And it was the opposite. It's the more I screamed, it turned them into a frenzy. and I feel them tearing at my clothing. I think my shirt, my sweater was torn off completely. My shirt was around my neck. I felt the moment that my bra tore, they tore the metal clips of my bra. They tore those open. And I felt that because the air, I felt the air on my chest, on my skin. And I felt them tear out. They literally just tore my pants to shreds. And then I felt my underwear go. I didn't even know that they were beating me with flagpoles and sticks and things, because I couldn't even feel that, because I think of the sexual assault was all I could feel, was their hands raping me over and over and over again. From the front, from the back. They were tearing my body in every direction at this point, tearing my muscles, and they were trying to tear off chunks of my scalp. They had my head in different directions, not trying to pull out my hair, holding big wads of it, literally trying to tear my scalp off my skull. And I thought, when I thought, I'm gonna die here, and my next thought was, I can't believe I just let them kill me.
Yes, Lara Logan in an interview from 60 Minutes. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, how can a behavior like this almost be, I wouldn't say accepted, but at least tolerated in a country like Egypt?
And it's not just Egypt. It is Algeria, it's Morocco, it's Tunisia. There was a video, again, horrifying, in Somalia a few years ago. You see this in Afghanistan, in Iraq. You see it in so many different countries. Those are broken down societies. There are young men who grow up in this environment and think like this and behave like this. And suddenly they make their way to Europe, very, you know, different European countries. But their attitude towards women has not changed in the least. And they are confused, and they're confused about so many things in life. But I think it's absolutely a miracle that Lara Logan survived this ordeal, that she's alive. Most people are not expected. Most women who become victims of this, they don't live. And they're not only left to die, sometimes even their bodies are left to rot.
So how do the men justify these disgraceful actions?
I think of it as a lynching. It is more than disgraceful. It is gruesome. It is horrifying. And the person, the Swedish person in your parliament who said this is medieval, is absolutely right. They don't justify it. That's the problem. The only way to justify it is by looking at a human being who is a woman and not think that she's human, that she's feeling pain, that you can have any kind of empathy for her. And a lot of these men, after an act like that, don't have any kind of remorse. In the book, I make a chronicle of, you know, I try as much as possible to get the testimony, you know, the side of the story of the perpetrators. And in court hearings, some of these men in Europe, they get upset. They think, why am I being punished? What have I done wrong? They still don't get it.
It's puzzling, because I think when you leave your own country and going to a totally different country, of course you expect the values to be different, and you must have heard that the values are different. Why are these ideas so hard to change then for some people?
Well, some of them they've heard, and they've had it frequently, that the values are different. For instance, if you listen to all the sermons of the Islamist preachers, and in many countries, as I describe in the book, the legal system, the social order has failed, or it's failing, it has disintegrated. And these Islamists, they come in and they become the moral reference for these societies. And these young men, they know that the values of Europe are different. But very often they've been told that the European values are inferior and that the Islamic values are superior. And again, without generalizing, a lot of these young men are very, very confused about the basic difference of what's right and what's wrong.
Hmm. To bring this back to Europe and how we're dealing with this kind of behavior here, sexual abuse of women is undoubtedly a big problem also here in Sweden, but something like this that happened with Lara Logan is extremely rare and would never happen in the presence of hundreds of people. So I'll have to ask you, isn't it obvious that immigrant men change their views and their behaviors when they live, for instance, in Sweden? Otherwise, these kinds of incidents would happen all the time, I reckon.
The only way they can change is for them to be compelled into changing it. And I think first you have to start with the generous position of saying, okay, we understand that you come from a different environment, and then, but you have to participate in programs where we educate you. If after you have learned of these values that are prevalent in the host country, in Sweden, various European countries, and you refuse to abide by those, then we're going to remove you from the country. See, that is a consequence. And these consequences have to be implemented and enforced consistently. Otherwise, they're going to make no sense. And people will see it as unfair if you remove one person and you don't remove another. So I think it is a big challenge for European countries to come out of this self-imposed, politically correct, taboo, whatever, this self-imposed inhibitions, and start taking this issue very, very seriously, because the number of men who are going to come from these countries is only going up, up, up. Why? Because the push factors, the issues that are pushing these men out, is becoming ever more serious. And the reasons for coming to Europe, you know, safe countries that are welfare countries, these are also very appealing. So I can tell you, the Swedish and other European elites, this is not a problem that's going to go away. You have to make it go away.
You claim in your book that this growing threat, on the contrary, actually has put Europe's politicians on the defensive, suggesting things like separating women from men in pool areas or in universities. Why do you think they react that way? Because they change their own system and sort of adapt to these medieval values then?
I think they think that by adapting small things like the accepting the separation of men and women, that over time the men will adjust and that these measures will not be necessary. But that's a fantasy. And the reason why it's a fantasy is, well, if you have just a handful, a few families here and there that you want to make feel welcome, and you say, okay, fine, we'll do things your way for a while, that's one thing. But here we are talking about hundreds of thousands. In fact, we're talking about millions of young men who have already made their way into Europe, and many more who are going to follow. So these types of soft approaches to resolving this issue is just not going to work. It is not consistent with reality. So if the leaders don't want to do, the elected politicians, if they don't want to address this issue, if they don't understand it, then perhaps they need to get out of the way, and voters should just elect leaders who have effective plans for doing this.
You give so many examples in your book of how liberal democracies time after time fail to defend the rights that women have fought for centuries. Some of the examples in your book comes from Sweden. For instance, when the Board of Migration and the Board of Health and Welfare published a brochure called For You Who Are Married to a Child. What's your problem with that way of communicating with immigrants?
What it says to the immigrant is that we in Sweden, we are ready to adopt your values, the values that you bring with you. So if child marriage is okay in the Middle East and you come to Sweden, we'll accommodate that. We'll make sure that it's okay here. Not for the white Swedes, that we call pedophilia, but if it's for you, you're different. So we're okay with a different set of values and laws for the minorities. And I think it's insane.
Another a little unexpected example in your book is the century-long tradition of nude sunbathing in Germany. You claim it's threatened for the same reason. How did that happen?
I spoke to people who are entrepreneurs who have this business, but also who, I don't want to call it an ideology, but they really believe that it is a form of high civilization to relax in these ways, have these nudist campuses. And yes, it's threatened because you have then people, again, young men from the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, going to these places in search of having sex with women, whether they want it or not. And that's how they view it. And again, this is a collision of values. It is a confrontation between, it's a conflict between what the facility was established to do, which was so that individuals can be free, not just free of the way this man explained, of legal and strictures like that, but also free of clothing and relax in a naturalist environment. But when the young man from the Middle East, South Asia, Africa comes in, he thinks, wow, naked women, I can just go and rampage. And then it is, how do the authorities respond? Then they say, okay, some authorities have said, maybe we should ban these nudist facilities, or these nudist facilities can be only same sex, or maybe people should wear something. It goes into everything. So there we are talking about nudist facilities. But in Austria, in Germany, I've spoken to women who were not nude. They were not in an environment that anyone could think of as being sexual. A young woman who is pushing a stroller with a baby in it and a toddler next to her walking in the park, being attacked by three men from Afghanistan, all of a sudden, who have never seen her before, who don't know her. That is not a sexualized environment. And still it happens.
Mm. A third example comes from a school in Germany where the parents of the pupils were told to reconsider how their daughters dressed in school. Why was such a letter sent out?
For the same reason. It's saying to, in this case, to the Swedish native people, not only do the immigrants have to adjust, we're adjusting by, you know, the child marriage example you brought. Okay, you can have a child marriage here in Sweden, but here now the Swedish population is being told, you have to adapt to the immigrants, the way you raise your daughters, the way you dress them, the way you send them to school. You adjust to the demands of the immigrant men. And this is just plain wrong. How about teaching the young men to restrain their sexuality and to learn to develop respect for women?
This plays into the discussion on whether assimilation or integration is the right way to go about this, because integration means to give and take a little bit. So if you have that perspective, maybe it's not that strange that you adapt. What's your view on what way is the most sustainable?
I would say there are values that have to be non-negotiable. Not give and take, just take. If you don't want to, you go back to your home country. And that, I think, is a fair negotiation. It's a fair way of doing things. If you think that women and the way they behave and their freedom is going to, that we are going to adjust to your prejudices and your values, then you're wrong. And but this, I know that most people feel this way in Europe. It's just that it has never been translated into an assimilation program. And here I am with assimilation. There are values that you can say give and take. For instance, anything about how people dress, what food they eat, what kind of music they listen to, how they bury their dead, that kind of thing. I think there's a great deal of give and take, live and let live. But when it comes to the violation of human rights, the freedom of movement, their safety, the bodily integrity, the freedom of speech, all of these, I think, should be completely non-negotiable. It is take or leave.
It is still, though, because we do have a law saying exactly that. Those things you mentioned are already illegal.
Yes.
to prevent someone from using the right to free speech or assaulting someone because they have a short skirt walking around the city.
Yeah.
So what more needs to be done other than enforcing the law?
It is very hollow if you say we have the law, but we don't enforce it. So, yes, you are absolutely right. We do have the laws and we have the values. Now, the next thing is simply to enforce it. And how do you enforce it? Now, there are some people, and usually they appear on the far right, and they say all the borders have to be closed and every foreign person has to be picked up and removed from the country. I think that is crude and it is immoral and it's unfair, especially to those immigrants who abide by the law and contribute to society. But there's a different way, a humane way of doing it. Most, especially North European countries, are welfare states that spend a lot of taxpayer money on social issues. And I think it is a very important social issue to develop programs that offer courses in values. The only demand that you then make as a society is to say that all individuals who are subject to this program, they have to take it. If they refuse to take it, there are consequences. If they take the program, now they've learned about all the values and they continue to behave in this way and threaten the bodily integrity, you know, all these freedoms that we've talked about, and they break the law, then you remove them from the country. And it has to be consistent, it has to be visible, it has to be transparent, and politicians have to be held accountable.
Do you know about any example, any country that applies this kind of policies that you're suggesting?
Austria and Denmark have started to apply it, and it's paying off. They are seeing a change in behavior. Austria, when I was writing that book, if you just look back in those years and you go through the archives, you'll see that at that time they were talking about a rape epidemic. If you took the train in Vienna, there was this newspaper, The Metro, I think it's still there, but the Metro was full of these incidents. And they had all these discussions about political correctness and integration in two different ways and the accusations of racism and the pretense that nothing was happening. They had all of that. At some point, it was unsustainable because they were just having these huge issues with social cohesion. And I've had similar stories in Denmark. And I think the politicians and the leaders were forced by the voters to make the right choice.
If they don't do that, if they don't deal with this, what will happen, you think, if politicians fail to do this, in your view?
I think you're going to have a meltdown of social cohesion. You're just going to have populations very hostile to one another, and they're going to take arms up against one another. And this is what I mean by institutional integrity. As long as people believe in law enforcement and in the justice system that it's working for them, then they will abide by the laws, abide by the rules. But if they have the sense that, okay, all I have is my family and myself and my community and the people of the same, I don't know, racial background as myself, then you get a tribalization of society. And I can tell you that's not attractive.
I've heard you in other interviews talk about the so-called woke culture that's spreading throughout the Western world, not the least in the United States. You consider that a threat to freedom as well. Why?
So this is, right now, it's mainly an American phenomenon. I think it's made its way to the UK and other English-speaking countries. It's a group of people who advance the idea that our society here in America is made up only of people who are oppressed and therefore victim, and people who are oppressors. and that these lines cut across racial lines, first black and white, and then sexual, so men and women, and then it's heterosexuals versus homosexuals, and then there is transgender, and on they go. So they've divided society into all sorts of different factions based on immutable biological traits, and their relationship is zero sum, and it can only be seen through the prism of power. Now, this is a very, very dangerous ideology.
Why? What can be the outcome of it?
Well, we're actually already seeing the outcome of it, because some of the suggested, recommended policies is to segregate black people from white people, homosexuals from heterosexuals. We are seeing our education system from K to 12. The children in the class are separated along their skin tone, not even just white and black, but in some cases, I've seen anecdotes of students, little ones, expected to draw in the, or to color in the skin tone, using crayons of their skin tone. It's just horrifying. But what in the end it's going to do is, again, it's going to set back the civil rights achievement, where people segregate voluntarily, but one group is going to feel oppressed and is going to act accordingly. And those who are accused of being oppressors are also going to act accordingly. So it's very dangerous. Extremely, it's also a closing of the mind. We're seeing this woke ideology manifest itself in the healthcare space.
Yeah, I've read about that. It's a paradox, though, since this culture has a self-image of striving for freedom for minorities. If this is not the path forward, how should problems with racism and discrimination be addressed instead, you think?
I think it's to move away from this group approach. Minorities, majorities, black, white, gay, straight, move away from all of these grouping of human beings together and think of ourselves as human beings, as one group, and then take the individual approach. And what that means is, it means what's already in the American Constitution, but also in the Swedish Constitution. And in many of these European constitutions is that we as individuals, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of religion, regardless of gender, we're equal before the law. And if there's any kind of injustice that is not visible, then it should be made visible and addressed accordingly. But move away from this groupthink and the advancing of groups.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a warm thank you that you participated in the Fredags interview from Kvartal. Pleasure to talk to you.
Jörgen, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Men John, de här fakturorna, har du koll på dem eller?
Att ha alla fakturor i en enda röra, det är inte Telia.
Oj, vad många.
Att göra det lätt att driva företag, det är Telia. Läs mer om fördelarna med att samla IT, bredband och mobilt hos en leverantör på telia.se/företag.
Hej, Susanne Axel här. När du gör som jag och listar dig på en av Krys vårdcentraler får du en fast läkarkontakt som kan din sjukdomshistoria. Du får träffa erfarna specialister, tillgång till lättakuten och så kan du chatta med vårdpersonalen. Så gör ditt viktigaste val idag. Lista dig hos Kry.
CSRD. Ännu en förkortning som väcker känslor hos företagare. Men lugn, våra rådgivare här på PwC har koll på det som din verksamhet berörs av. Från hållbarhetslösningar och nya regelverk till affärsutveckling och ansvarsfulla AI-strategier. Välkommen till PwC.